This program was recorded at the Foundations 4 conference at Quinter, September 2013. To find out more about Foundations conferences, go to www.foundationsconferences.com. www.foundationsconferences.com. Thank you.
What I'm going to share with you can only be an overview of all that took place and was learnt in those 8 amazing days. Because apart from anything else, my deadline is 45 minutes, and thou shalt not overrun. Much of it can only be said in general terms, because we are talking about individual human beings who inevitably respond to trauma in a huge variety of ways. So please forgive me if I make a sweeping statement and you know or feel otherwise. I was one of 23 international participants who had the privilege this past April of being selected to take part in this Christian leadership seminar. The theme was the Holocaust, anti-Semitism and Israel, and it was sponsored by Christian Friends of Yad Vashem and the International Christian Embassy, Jerusalem. Yad Vashem means a memorial and a name. On the course, we covered everything from the history of the Jews, God, Christian thought and theology, Jewish life before the Holocaust, the origins of and rise of anti-Semitism, the central role played by Hitler, the key fact of his personality, charisma and direction, without which it was suggested the Holocaust may well not have happened at this point and in European and world history. At least not in Germany and in such a way. We also considered literary responses to the Holocaust, cultural and spiritual resistance in the ghettos. Questions were considered in depth, amongst many, as to why the Allies did not bomb Auschwitz, the response of the world to what was happening. Did people know exactly what was happening? Why did so many do nothing? On the other hand, who were the righteous among the Gentiles? Their motivation, their achievements. What about the survivors? How did they survive? What about resistance? We learnt that resistance was more than just how we understand the word to mean, fighting or struggling against. The response among the survivors was to embrace life. Their revenge was to move forward, to build families, have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. That is the Jewish spirit. We also considered the huge subject of Holocaust denial, being given tools to combat this phenomenon by the author of Desecrators of Memory, Dr. Ephraim Kay, a brilliant communicator and teacher. And the whole subject was brought up to date by Dr. Susanna Kokkonen, the Finnish director of Christian Friends of Yad Vashem, and the inspiration behind these seminars, and also Dr. Jürgen Bühler of ICEJ, who spoke on the responses of the Christian world to the Holocaust and the Jewish state today. Also, a very interesting session was led by the Prime Minister's then advisor for Christian affairs, Rivka Kidon, on Israel and her neighbours, and the political realities of today. And we also had an evening session with Itamar Marcus of Palestinian Media Watch. It was an honour and also very interesting to be taught by Jewish educators such as Professor Robert Wistrich of the Hebrew University, a well-known author and expert on the Holocaust, and a dear rabbi, Rabbi Pesach Schindler, no relative of the Schindler. All of these dear Jewish people were teaching an international group of 23 Christians, and there were times when, despite their great knowledge and research, it was apparent to us that their outlook was different, their response as Jews being different from ours as Christians. Firstly, regarding the subject of Satan, as we would view Satan as a being who opposes God, rather than just a concept of evil. And also we know that the battle is because of Messiah. God has chosen the Jewish people, however much they wish not to be chosen, through whom to bring the Messiah. And this is why Satan always has and always will wish to destroy the Jewish people. But take heart, we know that he won't. God brought them out of Egypt. Haman was not able to destroy them. And God will preserve them to the end. So when one mentioned that he believed that they are now okay because they have the IDF, we as a group, including quite a few pastors and from different traditions, did not hide our beliefs, but we sought to tread carefully and sensitively and with respect for our teachers. It was most interesting and thought and prayer provoking. I cannot possibly enumerate and elaborate on every aspect that we considered, but here are just a few. A figure of 6 million killed, of whom 1.5 million were children, is something that no one can get their head around. So one needs to focus on individual lives, their lives before the Holocaust. What was Jewish life like? It was much like today in some respects. 10 to 15% of the youth were active and belonged to youth movements and believed it was in the power of the students to change the world. It is the story of people, of a people, of individuals, of neighbours. You need to rescue the individual from the pile of bodies. It is only when we identify them as individuals that we can relate to them. We learnt about the moral dilemmas that Jewish doctors faced in the ghettos. For instance, confronted with a huge number of diabetic patients and a limited supply of insulin, with no certainty of further supplies, who do you give it to? A little to everyone, or just give to those most likely to survive? Some of such moral dilemmas of the Holocaust are being taught in a course being run today at the Hadassah Hospital and very much appreciated by the medics. Also, the moral dilemmas of individuals, such as the mother at Treblinka, having to decide which of her two children to save. Today's students can learn from the Holocaust that even in a world of chaos, you still have choices. So we considered the role of choice and responsibility in life, how each bad choice made by an individual would lay the foundation and enable the next bad choice to be made until they rose to become one of the main perpetrators. Also, the choices and responsibilities of the nations. When asked at the Evian conference to take refugees, Australia, for instance, declined with the excuse that they did not have anti-Semitism in Australia and therefore they did not want to import that problem. We all know from the knowledge we already have of the Holocaust and from films how SS would kill Jews and then go home to their families. And we heard how one such perpetrator justified the killing of children because their parents, having been killed, wouldn't it be so awful for them to live without parents? Again, we considered the question of troops following orders. Befehl ist Befehl, orders are orders. Did they have to follow orders because otherwise they would be court-martialed or executed? We were told that apparently there is little evidence that this has happened, as opposed to actual warfare. Although a German lady at our CFI prayer conference in late April did tell me otherwise from a personal experience of hers. On the other hand, we looked at one righteous community in France, a case study, and considered what we learn about ourselves from their behaviour. And we considered the lives and responses of many figures, both well-known and obscure, and the lessons to be learnt from them. Another example being that of Viktor Frankl, who, after the Holocaust, wrote Man Searching for Meaning, to illustrate that without a shred of meaning to life, you could not survive the Holocaust. He came to Auschwitz with his dissertation and was asked what he was hiding. He was beaten and his dissertation torn up and told that a Jew cannot contribute to the meaning of life. After 20 minutes, he was stripped of everything. He was naked and without hair. The objective of the Nazis was to dehumanize them. At that moment, he wanted to commit suicide. But he decided he could still see, he could still hear. Then he had a panic attack. And someone noticed. This person moved just a fraction and looked at him with eyes of compassion. That small move and lack of compassion, look of compassion, gave him a meaning and enabled him not to let his spirit be killed, which was the aim of the Nazis. One Jew from Poland survived because when he escaped in 1942, he insisted he sleep in the barn of the home where he sought refuge. He was able to pass himself off as a Polish orphan, as he spoke perfect Polish and did not look Jewish. But all Jews in Poland were identifiable by their speaking Yiddish, and he could only conceal his true identity by sleeping in the barn, as he would wake up at night screaming in Yiddish. After the Holocaust, those who survived wanted to live and take revenge. Their revenge was to build families, begin cultural life. They didn't live happily ever after, for every night they screamed and returned to Auschwitz. Many never told their families about their story until decades later. But only by returning to life did they get meaning. We learnt of life in the ghettos and camps where they continued their Jewish lives, celebrating the festivals in the camps and ghettos despite the circumstances. The couple in the ghetto who had suffered childlessness for years only for her to discover in the Vilna ghetto that she was pregnant. She gave birth to a boy, a live birth which presented a huge danger to the community, who would be punished for this. On the eighth day, 10 men gathered to witness the Brit Mila. The Moel was about to perform the circumcision when 2 Germans turned up outside. The men froze. The Moel's hand began to shake. What to do? The mother made the decision, if they are going to shoot us all, let my son die, a Jew. She made that decision based on who she is. The lesson to be learnt for us all, all that you need to know who you are before you are faced with a decision. The 2 Germans apparently got out of the car, lit cigarettes, and having smoked them, drove away. She and the baby survived and immigrated to Israel. Many of us know that music was played in the ghettos and camps, and that certain musicians thereby escaped death because they were used by the Germans to give a semblance of normality. A certain Gideon Klein, a youth leader, who took responsibility for the younger ones in Theresienstadt, some of the boys snuck out of the ghetto and got a piano into Theresien for him. And did you know about the performance of Verdi's Requiem in Latin, performed in Theresien? The Jewish elders were opposed to the Jews doing this because it was Latin and Catholic. But Raphael Schechter nevertheless got 70 people together for a choir and organized an orchestra. He had one copy of the score. This was 1944. They taught every musician and every choir member the score. Their final performance was for the Red Cross and the Nazis. After the Red Cross had left, they were deported. They did not survive, but they did not allow their souls to be stolen. Musicals, revues, they continued to live and build. Even Molière was performed in the Warsaw Ghetto. Then there was the story of Jan Karski, who helped the underground. He was perfectly suited for that of carrying messages because he had a photographic memory. We considered the choices of what you would take when you had no time to think what to pack. You did not know your destination or even the purpose of your journey. What will I need? So what did they take? They took their books. We also considered and examined some examples of literature. The role of literature written in the Holocaust, diaries, poetry, stories, and also after the Holocaust, what it conveyed, how it differed from a pure telling of facts. So we considered a multitude of different aspects, but the two main stories of Holocaust education are history and memory. So, in 8 days, we had 15 90-minute lectures with 20 to 30 minutes break in between, if we weren't running late. Coffee, tea, water, and refreshments were freely available. Packed lunches provided with delicious schnitzel and cold chips in a falafel on a couple of occasions. For me, after 4 decades of being the one in front of the desk as the teacher, this was a novel but extremely scary experience, especially at one point when I made a particular cautious contribution and was promptly questioned further on it at 8:30 in the morning. As you know, I don't do mornings. My heart was thumping and I was desperately trying to pull the appropriate words out of my brain. In addition to those 15 lectures, which invariably began at 8 in the morning, we had 3 full-day tours. One on our first day up to the Galilee, taking in Caesarea, Megiddo, Capernaum, Tagba, and returning to Jerusalem via the Jordan Valley with a cut through part of Jericho. This day, which for most tours, even a Roy Thurley tour, would probably be a 2 or 3 day trip, was to get to know each other a little. And then in the evening, we had a session when we formally introduced ourselves. We were a mixed group of 23 from Canada and the US, 4 of us from the UK, Netherlands, Philippines, Singapore, Australia, Uganda, Finland, Germany, including pastors and a couple of government advisors from Finland and Uganda, Victor Schlatter, the author, an amazing man at 82 who founded South Pacific Island Ministries, having translated the New Testament and parts of the Old Testament into the language of Papua New Guinea, spawning a huge number of congregations. So at 82, he was the oldest, and his granddaughter Rachel, at 29, was the youngest. We gelled together brilliantly as a group, and on our only 2 free evenings, we met together without our educators to pray and minister to each other. We had an afternoon at David City when Yad Vashem needed to be cleared in order to put in the security for the evening's Holocaust commemoration. We had a whistle-stop day trip to Masada, Qumran and the Dead Sea, where somehow I ended up guarding the rucksacks and possessions of some of the group, laden with their cameras, whilst they floated and plastered themselves in mud. Whose camera was which? I hope I did them justice. Then we had a full day walking day tour of Jerusalem, from Gethsemane through the Lion Gate to the Peace of St. Anne's, along the Via Dolorosa to the Dungeon of Christ, to the peace and beauty of the garden of the Austrian Hospice in the Muslim quarter of the Old City, where, to Viennese music, we had coffee and Apfelstrudel. Lunch on the roof of a restaurant with amazing views, ending in the garden tomb where those sheep we had lost on the way were waiting for us, and a final view of the city from the Haas Promenade. On the Friday evening, Shabbat, we did as our Jewish hosts and walked to the synagogue, men downstairs, women upstairs, and did our best to follow the service. We were officially welcomed at the end, and as we filed out, I had the opportunity to talk to some curious young ladies, one still at school, one just out of the IDF, and explained what we were doing in Jerusalem. They were amazed and so appreciative. After walking back, we followed the Jewish ritual of hand washing before sitting at our large Shabbat table in the main dining room, hosted by Dr. Susanna Kokkonen and Stephanie and Ephraim Kay. We were then presented with our certificates, so we are now graduates of the International School of Holocaust Studies, or Yad Vashemniks, of whom Robin is also one, and Mike Fryer, whom you met earlier this week. All this in 8 days, and I'm far from finished. One afternoon, when considering the role of righteous Gentiles, we first saw an excerpt from Schindler's List. Then we visited Schindler's grave on Mount Zion at the Roman Catholic Cemetery in the presence of Nahum and Genya Manna, who met in his factory, married, and now live in Jerusalem and have a family of children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. We then spent precious time with them back at the hotel, poring over their family photos, her drawings, and also photos of them with Steven Spielberg and the film cast, just loving and treasuring them. And we each received a copy of the original Schindler's List, which Nahum and Genya signed for us, signed for each of us next to their names. Another afternoon, we walked the grounds of Yad Vashem, past the cattle car monument to the deportees, which hangs out on a limb on a track that seems to go into oblivion, symbolizing the journeys into the unknown that these poor dear people were compelled to take. We went through part of the gardens to the righteous Gentiles with monuments and trees planted in their memory, including the one to Corrie ten Boom, her father Casper and sister Betsy, who hid so many Jews in their watch shop in Harlem. Father Casper insisting when they were caught that they go with the Jewish people to the camps, which they did. We walked down into the valley of the communities. From above, it was impossible to imagine what lay below, where the names of so many obliterated and suffering Jewish communities are inscribed on huge pillars of that beautiful, light, sandy-coloured Jerusalem stone. There, in the small lecture room of the visitor centre, that you could never imagine was there, we met Hannah Pick, the close childhood friend of Anna Frank. And she told us her very poignant story from the beginning of their friendship, how their mothers met in a grocery store before they were 4 years old, and then they met in school. How Anna always had a notebook in her pocket and was always writing stories. I think it was Anna's mum who said, "God knows everything, but Anna knows better." Anna and Hannah did everything together. When the SS ordered Anna's sister Margot, a few years older, to report to go east, the family, as we know, went into hiding, due to Otto Frank having suspicions about this. Hannah did not know this, and when she knocked and got no answer, she was told by a neighbour that the Frank family had gone to Switzerland. Hannah's boyfriend had to go east, and she never heard from him again, despite everyone being sent letters to say they had all arrived safely and were at work. Such deception. Hannah's family was supposed to go to Palestine, but they were never allowed to leave. And she, her small sister and her father, her mother had died in childbirth, ended up in Bergen-Belsen. Thousands of prisoners from Auschwitz, including Anna, came to Bergen-Belsen in 1944. Miraculously, Hannah learnt that Anna, now 15, was beyond the wall, as current prisoners couldn't communicate with newcomers. The girls spoke on three occasions. Anna thought her whole family was dead. Her mother had died in Auschwitz, and Margot was very sick. In fact, Otto Frank was not dead, and Hannah felt that had Anna known this, it might have given her hope and the will to survive. Hannah used to throw Red Cross packages across the wall to Anna. Then one day, Anna was not there, and everything where Anna had been had gone. Hannah herself was put on a train to Russia and was liberated. And eventually she and her little sister, who had survived through several miracles, went to Israel. She said her deep religious faith had sustained her and still does. She is not angry because there is no one to be angry with today. What a beautiful lady, again a mother, grandmother and great-grandmother, having just acquired another great-grandchild a few days previously, revenge. But oh, how raw and real are those memories still. One afternoon, with headsets on and carrying folding stools, we walked through the museum for 3 to 4 hours, led by Ephraim, who explained the architecture and layout of the whole museum and exhibition hall. Designed by Moshe Safdie, it takes the form of a long, narrow, prism-shaped, triangular building, like a tube or cylinder that pierces Mount Herzl, with both ends cantilevering out into the open air. The gently sloping floor and narrowing prism enhances the changing narrative, creating the illusion of descending deep into the mountain, that being also at the lowest and gravest point of this history. As the museum nears its end, the floor begins to rise, the triangle opens up again, and the museum exits dramatically from the mountain's northern slope to a breathtaking view of Jerusalem. It is a 180-metre central walkway, and the prism floor is crossed by channels containing authentic artefacts, such as piles of books as were burned on Kristallnacht, and film footage, leading the visitor through the chapters of the story on either side, while maintaining visual contact with the two ends of the museum. The first part of the museum deals with events in chronological order, moving on to countries and communities that had not already been addressed. At the beginning is a moving, in both senses of the word, montage of Jewish life before the Holocaust. The intention was not to start, as some museums do, with piles of bones, but to show the life of individuals, people and communities, life before the horrors. And, as already mentioned, at the further end, the visitor emerges into daylight with views over the forests of Jerusalem. You have emerged from the horrors to new life, to born again Israel, which came out of the ashes of the Holocaust. Though Roy did explain to us this morning, there is far more to it than just that. The whole museum is a symbol of life before, during, and after. In only one place do you see pictures of bodies and bones, and only there because of the belongings and possessions on display, which were found in the pockets of half-burnt clothing and bodies. Two highlights of those 8 days, yes, we're still in those 8 days, were the two national commemorations that we attended. It was rather a crush to get in and through the two or three layers of security, ready to be seated in our allocated and personally named seats for the evening ceremony on Sunday, April the 7th. Once inside, it was all very relaxed, until the beginning, when the siren sounded throughout Israel at 8 p.m. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu spoke very movingly, as did Shimon Peres, the president, and both Israel's rabbis. Tony Blair was also in attendance. The memorial torch was lit, there was singing by the youth movement choir, somber readings from letters and psalms, Kaddish said by the chief rabbi of Israel, El Male Rachamin by the cantor Ashi Schwartz, and ending with Hatikva, sung very movingly by all. 6 memorial candles were lit by 6 survivors whose testimonies had been recorded and were on the video screen. Very poignantly, one candle had to be lit by the widow of one of the invited survivors who had died just some days before. The almost 2-hour ceremony took place on the Warsaw Ghetto Square, 70 years since the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. Afterwards, we were invited to the reception. The following morning, Monday, after an early lecture, the siren again sounded throughout Israel, and once again we trooped out to go through all the security again and to sit on our allocated seats on the square for the poignant wreath-laying ceremony with President and Prime Minister and also John Kerry from the US. Wreaths were laid by many organisations throughout the world, including the Mary Sisters and Pam Thomas of Bridges for Peace, who was here last year. And Rosie Ross from Love Never Fails. Afterwards, there were many moving ceremonies around the vast complex, particularly in the Hall of Remembrance, where the eternal flame burns with the names of many of the main death camps inscribed on the floor. Individuals and families with many generations present spoke the names of their lost loved ones at the podium before laying a flower on the relevant plaque, sometimes on more than one, as their loved ones have been shunted from camp to camp. It was hard to control the tears. As I said, This is just an overview of various points and lessons from this 8-day seminar. If before attending I had thought that I had only scratched the surface of this horrific, unprecedented and grotesque event from world history, I now realise how much more there is to study, to research and also to learn about both perpetrators and victims, but also about the triumph of the human spirit and ultimately, and not least, the role of God, if I can so put it. To many people, it is totally mystifying that in an apparently devout country like Germany, which produced the great reformer Martin Luther, a charismatic leader such as Adolf Hitler, Austrian by birth, should be wholeheartedly embraced, and that by the church. In the book that I have subsequently read, Battling with Nazi Demons, by Pastor Werner Older, son of an SS officer in Austria and now an evangelical pastor in Dorset, he quotes Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and physicist from the 17th century, who said, "Men never do evil so completely and cheerfully as when they do it from a religious conviction." And then Werner goes on to write the following, which is very sobering and also, I believe, a powerful warning to today's church. On September the 15th, 1909, 56 leading clergy of the Evangelical Alliance of Germany met to discuss reports of a great phenomenon which was occurring in America, Wales, and other parts of the world. These reports spoke of a great spiritual awakening among the population in Azusa Street of Los Angeles, where many people had turned to God because of a special work of the Holy Spirit. Supernatural healings took place, and many prophecies were given by ordinary people who were impacted by God. In Wales, pictures of Christ appeared on the walls of churches supernaturally, which many devoted individuals believed to be a warning from God of a great suffering to come upon the world. The German clergymen discussed for 19 hours the present outpouring of the Holy Spirit and the consequential birth of what is known today as the Pentecostal movement. They concluded that this was not from God, but from the devil, and stated, "The so-called Pentecostal movement is not from above, but from below. Demons are at work in it, led with cunning by Satan. Lies are mixed together with truth to lead the children of God astray. Neither the personal faithfulness and devotion of some individuals, nor the healings, tongues, and prophecy which accompany this movement can change our conviction that this movement is from below." They effectively said, "We do not want another Pentecost." This declaration led to a national rejection of the Holy Spirit that is affecting Germany to this day. Because the German Christians did not acknowledge the Holy Spirit, they were later unable to identify the spirit from hell which brought Hitler on the scene. The theological prejudice of the German church opened the door to the demons of antisemitism, who came in and smashed the Gothic cathedrals, burned the synagogues, and destroyed the Jews. The great majority of Austrians welcomed Hitler, supported his cause, and believed in his ideals, despite their religion. How can religious people be so deluded? 1 week after Austria joyfully welcomed Adi home, Austrian bishops blessed the National Socialism on Adolf Eichmann's birthday, March the 18th, 1938, stating, "From inner conviction and with free will, we, the undersigned bishops of the Austrian Church province, acknowledge joyfully that the National Socialist movement has contributed greatly towards the growth of social politics for the German Reich." Within days of the church blessing the Nazis, prisoners from the concentration camp in Dachau were transferred to Linz to start the construction of Mauthausen concentration camp on August 7th, 1938. The Austrian church simply failed to recognize the spirit from hell that was rising in their midst. Where did this religious deception, which drew scores of devout Catholics and Lutherans into the web of satanic conspiracy against humanity, come from? The answer lies with many so-called church fathers whose theology was used to form the base of the modern church. I have no time to quote further, but I would thoroughly recommend this book for further reading. I was actually in Israel for longer than those 8 days, and as I look back, I realise that those people whom I met, specifically the Jewish artist whom I sat next to on the plane over, and the Palestinian pastor and his family, whom I visited in Bethlehem, would be significant. After the seminar, in particular, I visited Shevet Achim on Prophet Street, where, with Jonathan Miles, the founder, and international volunteers, we had a Kurdish lunch prepared by the Iraqi women from Kurdistan. After lunch, I was part of a group accompanying the 4 Kurdish women and their children just recovering from their heart surgeries. Shaida, about 1, 2-year-old Ayad, 6-year-old Mohammed, and 12-year-old Jawana. And we went to the Garden Tomb. That was something else. To go to the Garden Tomb with these Muslim women. Jesse, an American who speaks fluent Kurdish, explained to them the story. Then we moved to the place of the skull in the rock face, where we prayed and Jesse translated, moving then to the empty tomb where they went inside. I can only say it was an awesome experience. I said goodbye to them as we left the Garden Tomb, and despite the lack of a common language, there was a real rapport as we hugged and kissed. I mention this because Shevet Achim brings these sick children over from countries, including Gaza, which are officially enemies of the State of Israel, children whose lives are blighted by very serious heart problems, to be operated on under the loving care and expertise of Jewish doctors and nurses who donate their time to give back life to these people, to the children and their families. It is a beautiful work which again demonstrates the spirit of the Jewish people, their love of life, their response to those people whose leaders call for the destruction of the Jews. How wonderful it would be if the BBC and its ilk would concentrate on informing the world of such positive, life-changing deeds and attitudes which promote reconciliation. If you want to know more about Shevet Achim, please go and see the stand over there and talk to Jessica and support her valuable work. So, out of the ashes of the Holocaust has come forth a people whose God-given spirit has not been crushed and who truly embrace life, indeed bringing life to those trapped in a prison of darkness. But we still need to constantly pray for this people, most of whom do not yet know their Messiah, this land and this city, whom the enemy has sworn to destruction. So please pray for the peace of Jerusalem. And if you want to know any more about this seminar or you are interested in it, there are some leaflets and booklets over there. You can ask Robin, you can ask me. They accept applications from anybody in Christian leadership. Yes, there are Yad Vashem magazines over there. And by the way, when I mentioned Werner Older, this pastor who is the son of the SS officer, he is speaking at the Emmaus Group conferences in November in Crawley and York, and that is what those flyers I've put out are about. I haven't yet met him, but I really look forward to meeting him. So, thank you.
Thank you, Moira. Okay, it's this thing called free time now for 2 hours. Okay, so off you all go.